possibly bleak as this. Drogba! They've pulled the rabbit out of the hat again. The City are still alive here. Balotelli. Aguero! I swear you'll never see anything like this ever again.
The Offside Rule exclusives with Kate Borsay and Lindsay Hooper.
We're very kindly joined by Martin Tyler, and this is a very different podcast for us because usually we've had people who are currently playing in football or managing, but of course the football stories you've got, we couldn't resist coming along to Woking and having a chat. I wondered, first of all, when you very first picked up a microphone.
Gosh, you're stretching me now. It's a long time ago. I wasn't trained as a broadcaster. I never really expected to go into broadcasting. I've obviously at times thought back in my more wistful moments as to why it happened, how it happened. I remember being asked to do a hospital radio broadcast before I did my first television test, really. I did a couple of those before my first actual television broadcast. It was in, I can tell you the game, I think it was about 1974. It was early in 74. It was a cup tie between West Ham and Hereford. And a friend of mine who was a professional cricketer, Jeff Howarth, captain of New Zealand and a flatmate of mine, he knew somebody, I think connected with his girlfriend, who ran the hospital radio at West Ham. And they had two or three people who did it. But on this particular day, and one, they were short. And somehow I got recommended to go. And I had, you know, I was working in football then. I'd been playing non-league football prior to that. So I'd been coached by some very good people. So I always had my views on it. And I was fascinated by the game at the top level. So, yeah, I went and did it. I don't know quite how it went. It was a very unusual experience because I'd done no broadcasting, but I sat next to another guy and we got through the game. I think it might have been a draw. I think Hereford were a bit of a surprise team. I know that West Ham played them a few times around that time, but it wasn't one of the great giant killing days, but it was a Saturday afternoon. So that was the first one. The second one was I asked if I could go to a game that LWT were covering. I was working for LWT on the big match and on the ball. I got my chance in television through, I guess in those days, who you knew rather than what you knew. But we worked a system. It was great. It was fantastic. The big match and On the Ball were really big. On the Ball became the St. Greavesy later on, because you're too young to remember any of this. And we worked a system where we worked so hard over two weekends, we got the third weekend off. So, in fact, there were three people doing jobs for two, really. And so on that third weekend in, I think, October 1974, I asked if I could go to the game, which ITV were covering, London Weekend were covering, which was Arsenal against QPR. And I took something not dissimilar to what we're talking to now. It was obviously a 1974 version of it. And recorded a commentary. Just, I don't know. I'm sure I never thought it would lead to anything that has happened. But, of course, being in television, I played it back to somebody who had some influence. Not that I did it for influence. I just wanted to know what they thought. And he was a guy called Bob Gardam, who was the top director of ITV for many years. A once met, never forgotten guy. And of course, my gratitude to him when I finish off the story is immeasurable, because about 3 weeks later, Southern Television, as they were called, Meridian now, rang up and they said, "We were short of a commentator for one game. Do you know anybody? Because everybody else is working." I was in the office when this call came in, and you know, sometimes you get a sixth sense of what's going on, and I thought, oh my God, he's going to talk about me. And half of me was going, please talk about me, and the other half was going, please, for God's sake, don't talk about me, because I've got no experience. Anyway, he did, and they said, well, we'll take a chance, we need to hear him again. So I did a proper test, and on December the 28th, 1974, they wheeled me in for my first ever television game. And the Christmas, I mean, we're obviously talking at this time now around Christmas, and I couldn't eat my turkey. I was sick to my stomach for 3 or 4 days. I had no experience. I wasn't a broadcaster, but, you know, I played some football and I'd got some belief in love for the game. I think that was the most important thing. He said to me at the end, he said, "Well, old boy, well done, old boy. We've got another one in a couple of weeks. Would you like to do that?" And my payoff line is, ever since then, people have been saying, "We've got another one, hopefully in a couple of days, you know, rather than a couple of weeks." And it kicked on from there. And then John Motson, before I knew John, because I was working behind the scenes in television, I'd met him. And I've still got it at home, and you won't even know what this is. He sent me a telegram. So I've got it. It's the piece, but it was actually in an envelope delivered to me. And it said, "Good luck. Talk little, but say a lot." And I thought that was wonderful advice. And I've always been grateful to Motti for taking an interest then. And we've gone on parallel careers, really. So
it's a fascinating story. And I just wonder, part of me wonders, what did you want to do when you were a lad? How different is it to what you ended up doing?
I wanted to be in the team photo on this wall at Woking Football Club. I wanted to play for Woking. I wanted to play professional football. And now, at the age of 73, having come here as an eight-year-old, I'm finally on the team photo.
As assistant manager here at Woking, I know Lindsay started off with, we normally speak to players and managers. I'm thinking, hang on, we've got a manager here.
Well, an assistant.
It kind of might be a round and about sort of way that you got here, but you're here.
The nearest I've got to working for the BBC, balls, bibs and cones. That's the job of mine at training nights, making sure everything's set up for the players when they come out. I did want to play. I wanted to play both football and cricket. In those days, that was what sport was, you know, cricket in the summer, football in the winter, and they didn't really overlap too much. And there were players who, famous players like Dennis Compton, people like that, played for Arsenal and played cricket for England. And they were sort of my role models, really. My background is much more cricket than football. There was no football in my family at all. But my mother's side of the family, I was born in Chester, and my mother's side of the family all played cricket for Cheshire and the minor counties. They were very good cricketers. And so I grew up a little bit with, they taught me a lot about the ethics of sport, how to win and lose properly. You know, that was something that was drummed into me. You do that with dignity. And I can't say I've been a slave to that, but I've tried really hard always to, finish off games, handshake and do the right thing, you know. And we're certainly doing that when Watford come to play us. And we try and do everything the right way. And that's Alan Dowson, who's the manager I've worked with for the last 12 years and the man who foolishly has taken me into this world alongside my parallel life as a commentator. He's always done things the right way. And that's the only reason I've been able to stay with him, because, you know, you girls know from our broadcasting expectations that you can't get embroiled in anything that's underhand or something that you're ashamed of.
How does that relationship work with Douse, as you call him? Or as everyone calls him, I think.
Yeah, everybody refuses to answer to Alan. there was one player at one of the clubs who deliberately called him Alan all the time to wind him up. It works that he's a very talented manager with a lot of drive and determination, but every manager needs a bit of help, and I come very cheap. I've never taken a penny from any of the clubs that we've worked at, because obviously I'm very blessed to have an income from a job that I'm very lucky to have as well. So I just try and fill in the gaps for him, really. I mean, he's the driving force. It was never meant to happen.
If we're talking about things working fortuitously or we're talking about destiny, where does ambition come into it? Because I think Lindsay and I notice sometimes as well, being, you know, ourselves, I'm over 40, Lindsay's approaching 40, and we are able to sit back and notice the new generation of broadcasters coming through and often how hungry and how ambitious they are and how a lot of it's about promoting yourself.
That's I know exactly the point you're making, because I'm not on social media. I can understand why people are. I really can. There are two reasons on it. One, I don't have the time to, if you like, live up to the expectation of having a Twitter account. And two, I know myself too well that something, and it might not be about me, it would be something in the world, and I would snap at, and I would definitely make myself look an absolute prat by a knee-jerk reaction. And I just don't trust myself to be in a position to do that. So the rants go to my kids or Douse or whoever I'm spending time with, Gary Neville or something. We go, wow, how can he?
What do you rant about there? Because you seem so calm. Your commentary is exciting, but it's always, you always seem very much in control of whatever's going on, measured. So between us, what gets your goat?
Injustice.
Yeah, is that partly to do with the way you were brought up as well? Because often I find that
I was brought up in the post-war years where, you know, everything on television was the good guys beating the bad guys. I liked that; it resonated with me. I mean, there's not always justice in football. We can play really, really well and lose, and I think that's hard. When I'm commentating, I like the team that plays well to win. Yeah, you know, that's probably the nearest thing I have to a personal opinion on it, because I think if you do well and sometimes the real drama is something that is a bit unjust. I mean, it was tough, for example, in recent memory. It was very tough on Everton, the nature of the goal and the fact that a goal came in so late to rob them from getting something from Anfield. The strangest goal, I mean, passing. One thing that it reminds you of, you've never seen everything that can happen in football, because I've never seen a goal in all the football matches that I've been involved in as a fan, as a player, as a coach, as a commentator. I've never seen a goal like that. So I was quite pleased that I actually saw it, because when Virgil van Dijk kicked the ball up in the air, you thought, well, that's it, game over. I think everybody in the ground on the pitch thought game, except Divock Origi, and great credit to him. Well, he didn't just happen to be there. He saw what was happening and got the reward for it. I just try and judge things as they happen, and I try to be very fair. I think that's all really, that's the bottom line you should ask of a commentator, is to be fair. And that's probably, if anybody ever says that I think you're fair, that's the nicest thing that I would have said about me, because I know people say I support all these various teams. I categorically, you've got people in this stadium where we're talking now who will back up my true claim that I've been a Woking fan since I was 8 years old.
It shouldn't matter though, right? I mean, even if you were a fan of another team, and I know that Manchester United is one that is thrown at you all the time, it shouldn't matter, because that is your passion in your spare time, and this is your job.
I told you about social media. I would bridle at that. And then the Daily Telegraph did a wonderful thing after the League Cup final, the EFL Cup final a couple of years ago, when they printed two tweets. One said, the most biased commentary in favour of Manchester United I've ever heard. And the other one, they were playing Southampton, said, the most biased commentary in favour of Southampton I've ever heard. Both different Twitter accounts, and they printed them out. And I thought, that's really kind of you to do that, because that's the way people see it. And I have no issue with people having opinions about what I do. They're quite entitled to think that. But I'm not a fan of any Premier League. It seems to be a given that you have to have a Premier League team. Well, I don't. And it's helped my work a lot. The hardest part about bias, if you like, is, and I'm sure you find it the same, is you get to know people and you want them to do well. And I occasionally, one story I can tell you is, if you listen to it, and I think it's on YouTube, I was very tight with my non-league background as a fan and as a player, and now as a coach. When Ricky Lambert got in the Premier League with Southampton, I was thrilled. I'd seen him on the way up. I remember doing a game at Bristol Rovers when he scored, and I just thought it was a wonderful story, a great example to everybody. And then, so our first game of that particular season, the Manchester City, the defending champions, and they get Southampton, who've just been promoted, Manchester City v Southampton in August, whenever it was. So I go down to watch, as I do in my prep, I go down to watch Southampton train, and I see Ricky, and I was, that's great. He said, no, I'm only sub. I'm not going to start. So the game happens, and you know the story. He comes on a sub, 4 minutes later, he scores. If there's any bias in my work, listen to that commentary. I was thrilled for him, absolutely thrilled for him. And that's where, a personal feeling might come into it. But I promise you, I've commentated on Woking games, actually, and certainly not been biased in that. It's easy when it's just two teams on the pitch. Afterwards, you feel a bit. They beat Millwall away, actually. Clive Walker of Chelsea, I'm Chelsea TV now. I see him a lot, Clive. He had a spell here at the end of his career, scored the winner at Millwall, and we did it live on Sky Sports. And I suppose when I said the final score, it might have had a little bit of woomph in it. But the game, I promise you, was probably, if anything, I favoured Millwall because you try to do that to make sure people don't think you're biased, you know.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Offside Rule TV, for exclusive video football content.
Let's talk about firsts. And your first World Cup would have been 1978, I believe.
Yeah, I was very lucky. There was no recording facility, so we had to find out about these teams. You had to go and see them. So we were given £500 each, the four of us, to go around Europe to watch some of the teams play. Because they all, and funny enough, the competition was Argentina and Mexico. My first game, Mexico versus Tunisia, was my very first World Cup finals commentary. And by a complete stroke of good fortune, Mexico were playing a German club side. Why? I never bothered to find out. Anyway, I went to the game. It was in Bochum, and in Germany, and I watched the game. And in that game, they got a penalty, Mexico. And the penalty taker was the captain, Vasquez Ayala, his name was. So after the game, I still didn't recognise them all, and of course they hadn't all played, so the next thing you do as a commentator is you hover, skulk, if you like. You lurk around looking to see them, and then they were waiting to get their bus back to their hotel. And I saw Vasquez Ayala, and I, for some reason, I said to him, penalty, always that way. I'm pidgin Spanish. I don't know whether he understood a bit of English. Always, he said, I always put my penalties that side. Well, 30 minutes into my very first game, Mexico get a penalty. And I took a deep breath and said, well, I've seen him take a penalty, and he always puts it to the goalkeeper's left. And then held my breath, and he did. He did. And that was my very first goal in the World Cup. And I prepped for it by the diligence that I would recommend anybody who wants to follow in the footsteps of any of us commentators. If you put the work in, it's no guarantee. It's like playing. If you train hard, you should play well, but you don't always. But that was, I always tell that as a story that if you like, attention to detail. And wanting to talk to them, you know, wanting to not just say, oh, I can recognise you. You know, what is it? Sometimes it's easy to have some. It was a bit easier in those days to find players to talk to. But, yeah, that's the story for you anyway.
Is it enough like that these days? Because we can access so much on YouTube, so much is available online. And, you know, I completely credit you with still doing proper research, going to watch the teams play. Is there a danger that there's so much instantly accessible to us now that side of the skill of being a commentator will be lost?
I do YouTube research, and if I get a team where I really, you know, I still work on the Champions League for the world feed, you know, so we don't win a bit more at Sky, as you know. So I may be not have the opportunity. We do these games off-tube, as it's said. For those listening, that's from a monitor in a studio where you pretend that you're there. Well, you don't pretend. It's pretty easy to do. Mm. It's not as hard as it. You look at your monitor when you're actually at the game sometimes. So so I might do. I might get a team where I've not seen them for a while, and you can go player by player. And I use it. I would look at their skills, and then I'd ask for on the search. I'd search for an interview, so you'd really see them in their face, and also get a little bit. Obviously, some of the interviews are done in English for the foreign players anyway, and so I think it's a good tool. Yeah, if you can get to the game, but the games come so thick and fast. You remember in those days when I'm talking back in the '70s, I might do one game every 2 weeks or something like that. You know, maybe when I was at York's Television, it'd be one game every Saturday, but you'd have the whole week to research it. And maybe because of a lot of lower division football, they'd be playing on the Tuesday. I travel up and down. I used to go through a car a season. You know, cars weren't so good in those days as they are now.
Bit like Lindsay.
Diesels run longer now.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, but they don't break down as much as they used to. But I used to just I'm the least mechanical person in the alive, I think. So,
hotline to the AA.
Yes. It was. But at the end of the season, I always changed it because it was falling to bits. So, yeah, we did a lot. Listen, use what's available. That would be my tip. And the internet is brilliant. I mean, I'd be stupid to say I don't use it.
I'm curious to know, being that your career is so long and experienced, who you've taken great interest, who, or perhaps a team, or even perhaps the style of play, the way the game's now played. What have you followed with interest throughout your career where there's been a significant difference? What or who?
I think I like to see the good in all of it, you know. I mean, I'm 6'3" and I was a non-league centre forward. I love players like that because I know how difficult it was for me to try and achieve anything at that. I was thrilled last week when Southampton scored with three headers. I know that's all I could do. That was my big skill, and I think it's changed in the game, but the football has changed. The game has evolved. It's much more of a passing game. I get a little bit concerned about the playing from the back because only Premier League players on Premier League pitches, I think, can do it. And if you're a kid thinking I should play like John Stones, for example, and you play in your local team and you're 10 years old and you think, oh, that's the right way to play, and you lose the ball three times, the opposition score three times, you may never play football again because at that age it will break your heart. And I do think we've got to be careful in trying to replicate some of the very top level of playing. It's almost like a different game, and they're wonderful at it. And I don't have any issues about commentating on it or admiring it. But I do. I am concerned in the coaching side of it that it's just not maybe the way. I mean, we've got professional players here at Woking. We do not play from the back because the pitches aren't good enough. And we love it if the opposition do because we think we can pounce, you know, not because the players we're playing against aren't skillful enough, but one little bobble on the non-league pitch and you're in, you nick the ball and you're 30 yards from goal. And so I think that's a concern I have. But no, I just admire them. It's what I wanted to do and was never quite good enough to do. Never good enough to do.
He joined Sky in 1990. Of course, you're still there now. And we'll talk in a little bit about the sort of latter part of your career. But I wanted to ask about Keys and Gray and the change in football, really, when it comes to considering women, from women broadcasters to looking at women's football. How did you interpret the Keys and Gray situation? And if our listeners aren't familiar, they had a bit of a go at a female linesman, saying that she didn't know the offside rule. That also was the birth of a podcast as well. But how did you feel about that happening to your fellow professionals?
It's a very difficult subject for me to talk about because obviously I worked very, very closely with both of them. Strangely enough, yesterday, we played Maidstone United away with Woking, and that year, that day, the day of when Andy was sacked, I was at Kingstonian coach driving to play Maidstone United away, and that was the first time since. And Douse actually flagged it up because I got to the ground, in a state of obviously some shock, really, because what had happened very quickly. I can't sit here and say that it was the wrong decision. On a personal level, Andy Gray to commentate with he balanced me off unbelievably. I mean, we almost did role reversal because the commentator, if you like, the play-by-play guy, which is me, is supposed to shout and scream, and the co-commentator is supposed to be cool and analytical, and we were the other way round, you know. Andy was the one going, take a bow, son, of huge, huge levels. I haven't really talked about it before. It's a painful subject because, two lives were changed dramatically, and I saw the pain. And Andy's spoken quite recently, quite publicly, about how he was close to, suicidal feelings about because it happened. It was so... such a deep happened so quickly. On the other hand, I do understand, and I saw at first hand some of the reasons behind it. Sean Massey is still running the line very, very well today, yeah. which is yeah. great credit. And she didn't instigate any of it. She was just part of it. I think the world is a better place if some of these things happen, and there will be people who perhaps shouldn't necessarily be victims of it, but because the world needs to improve, and I do think it's improved, I think it's massively improved, whether they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time doing the wrong thing, their defense would be everything that they said was with good humor and fun. I can say from personal experience, because even some of it was directed at me, that it wasn't always good humor and fun. But I genuinely believe that's they thought that. So I don't want to slag off two wonderful professionals who are still working and who have hopefully taken on board a lot of why things went wrong for them. But it was a big change at the time, and I can only compliment Sky. They've found the right guys to take over. And Rich and Andy have found another tree to get to the top of, and credit to them for that. And I'm sure they're older. They're certainly older. I'd like to think they're wiser. And it made everybody sit up and take notice. And that was an issue. And there have been issues in recent times. And, you know, I do think inclusivity is a really important thing. I've grown up with women in football all the time, you know, whether they've maybe not been broadcasters when I started, but they've been club secretaries and they've been around the game, and they've been very much a part of what we, you know, what we regard as the football industry. So I'm sure it wasn't meant as disrespectfully as it came out, but it did come out very disrespectfully.
Let's bring it on to commentating, actually, and bring it into your sphere. Why do you think there has been so much resistance to a female voice commentating in football? It seems there's been acceptance in areas like reporting and on-screen faces presenting. But when it comes to commentary, there still is that resistance. We had Jackie Oatley with Match of the Day some years ago. We had this World Cup where we saw Vicky Sparks introduced. And there still seems to be that backlash.
I'm not so sure you're right. I think one of the issues is always said that the female voice doesn't lend itself quite to the, I suppose, the gravitas, if you like, and that's only part of commentary, that it's a different pitch. And part of being a successful broadcaster is getting over the hurdle from being a new voice to being a comfortable voice. And once you do that, you get away with a lot more mistakes, because people go, oh, well, your voice is associated with it. I've been privileged to have my voice associated with football, and obviously there are many other people we can name with different sports. So I think it's getting people used to it. So the only way that's going to happen is regular commitment. And I'm disappointed too. I have to declare an interest here that I know Vicky Sparks because her sister is my daughter's best friend. So I knew Vicky before. Well, she was actually, when I first met her, I met her up in the Northeast, and we talked about all these things a few years ago now, but she hadn't made any national impact. But I could tell. She had strong views about the game. I was probably talking to her about the game I was going to commentate on the next day. She was doing commentary on non-league football at Gateshead and places like that. So I was really taken by her whole football personality as well. She's a very nice person as well, but her broadcast ability. And I've been actually banging the drum for around wherever I've gone. She has one slight advantage. Her voice is a little bit deeper than some of the other girls, really. And I do think that she's probably got the best chance of regular, you know, of getting into that sort of zone where we just think, oh, that's Vicky, it's football, you know? I really think it's mostly that. I don't deal with ratings. I don't deal with viewers' complaints unless they're about me. And obviously I have to deal with them then. But I wonder whether some of the girls who come into it see a greater value. I mean, Alex Scott's been amazing. I mean, she's gone from being a player to being a pundit, just like, if you like, Gary Neville. She's another right back. Maybe the right backs are the ones that should be doing this. But I wonder whether she could do commentary, you know? I mean, some people are suited to it and some people are, I mean, temperamentally, not in any other way. For some people, the prep is too much and the being on screen is what makes them have a glow. And Alex certainly has a fantastic glow on screen. So I think it will happen. I don't see any reason at all why it shouldn't. I mean, people say the wrong thing. Plenty of men say the wrong things at wrong time on television. I'm one of them. And you know, nothing's said, really. Oh, well, maybe it is said, but not, it's not a sexist thing. It's just a particular personal criticism. So I think the door is there. I don't think the door is shut. It's really just somebody needs to perhaps pull it back from the inside as well as a woman commentator barge through it, you know.
The Offside Rule exclusives are available to download for free via Audio Boom and iTunes.
How much do you see the landscape changing in terms of the influx of women in the media, ethnic minorities, which are being brought through at a fast pace as well, because it's been so behind the times?
I think the world is improving. I do think in terms of, you know, the approach to, say, racism. We've had the Raheem Sterling stuff recently, and we think, well, that we've moved on from that, haven't we? But no, we haven't. Something happens like that. But it is rarer, and it's also actually noticeably older people. But and I talked to Brian Henderson, the cricket producer at Sky, and I love cricket, and I've watched a lot of his work, and we talk because the girls in the cricket are unbelievable. I think they're the best example, and he's had a go at football saying, well, I think you should do more, and I think more is being done, you know. But the interesting thing about the cricket commentators, they've worked in cricket as well. They have their positions of authority, they're coaches in cricket, and I think that gives them that kind of depth of knowledge. I'm constantly amazed how good they are, and how they live in the man's world, total equality, and the men accept it as total equality. In football, I think it's been a bit slower, but it's well on the move, and Sky are playing a big part in it. And I think, you know, the fact that we're having this conversation, you've had careers, and you will tell me, I should be asking you, really, about how difficult it's been for you, and how has it improved? I mean, has it improved for you too in the course of...
I think
please tell me yes, because otherwise I've just wasted my breath.
No, I mean I think for Kate and I, our generation definitely benefited more than the generation 10 years older than us, compared to the 10 years older than that, compared to the 10 years older than that. And I think the real positive thing for us is, although we may not have got everything handed to us, there's definitely been a lot of barriers that have needed to be broken down.
Do you think the men have had it handed to them?
I don't think it's been handed, but I think it's just been, it's been easier. It has been easier for men who wanted to go down the same route. I mean, and that's just a numbers game. That's just by looking at a press room and seeing how many men are in there and how many women. You know, from that point of view, that's a numbers game, isn't it?
I think in answer to that question about whether it's easier for the men, I think there are less barriers for a man to get into broadcasting and particularly fronting shows, or there have been, than women. So back in our day, which is 15, 20 years ago almost, there were often reasons why a woman wouldn't be put in front of a camera behind a desk, but there were never really those questions about men.
I tell you the biggest thing that's changed, and that's what I would want to encourage people who listen to our podcast, who listen to you and your experience, is it's about the knowledge. And I think women for a long time weren't seen as experts. They were just seen as a bit of eye candy to sit next to the men who were experts, for instance, in a television.
Well, don't you think some of the men were eye candy as well? I mean, in terms of that they got on because they look good on the screen, and I'm sure...
I could name you quite a few that probably aren't there for that reason, though.
No, but yeah. I've never...
No, I don't think so.
No.
No, well, I don't think... I don't think, you know, men and eye candy. I mean, it's different because, for example, I've never worked in a sport capacity for the BBC. I've only ever worked at Sky and at other organisations and at football clubs. And I can honestly say in my experience that there was never a case of, well, we'll get so-and-so on because they're eye candy. Maybe we'll get, you know, Mr. X on because he's an ex-player and he's well-known or he's got a good social media following. But as I said, often there were more obstacles in front of us as women. Her nose is too big. She talks out the side of her mouth. I don't like the way her hair is. Often obstacles like that. And I'm talking early days now, perhaps not, not recently.
I'm sure you're right. I wouldn't disagree with you, but I've known people, and maybe I'm one myself. I'm not on camera very much, and I've never really had the desire. I think presenting is a different skill altogether, and I'm an out and about person. Mm. You know, I'm at my most comfortable in the football ground. I could come here and bring my laptop and work in the football ground because I really feel I sort of belong. But I've known decisions made on people. We can't put him on. You know, he won't do pieces to camera. And so I do think there's a bit of that. I agree. I'm sure the bar's set higher when it comes to choosing ladies on the screen. But I see many more, the knowledge level. I mean, I was thinking about, I thought Hayley might be here today. I grew up in no football in my house. She grew up with a dad who I loved to bits, by the way. Gordon played a big part in helping me as a player when I saw a lot of him. And I worked with him as a co-commentator as well. So the amount she learnt about football and not just how the game's played, but the lifestyle. And that's very important to know how and when to address people. One of the great skills, I think, for football reporters is to pick your moment to speak, particularly after matches, and our after match reporters put Mourinho's last ever interview on Sky Sports. Jeff Shreves, you put your head above the parapet going in there to do that, and I think people like Hayley, well, that she'd know exactly how and when to speak because she's seen her dad in so many situations as a coach as well as a player. So I think that background actually can help people as well, and that kind of knowledge is not the knowledge perhaps that we're talking about sort of studying the game, but just smelling it, you know.
Yeah.
And I always, people say, well, how do you prepare for a game? And I spoke to, funnily enough, yesterday, it was written up on the board in the office we just come out, Martin at West Byfleet Primary School, 9:30, 18th of December. And that's my old primary school. And I was there in a group of 8-year-olds talking about commentating when somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, Mourinho has been sacked, you know. And so I discussed that with 8-year-olds and they knew what, because they're exposed to football now. And there were girls, it was mixed, you know. In fact, actually, the best girl commentator is on Chelsea's books as a whatever you can be at 8 years old, 9 years old, but trains with Chelsea. So she knew what she was talking about, and what they'd actually done is filmed the game that they played in before I got to the school, and they played it on as you would with all the technology. Now they played the match for them to commentate on their own match, and I'm looking at the match and thinking, oh, she's good. And that's another thing that's helped, I think, in football. The quality of women's football has improved so much. I remember doing an international in the early years of Sky, England against Italy, I think it was. The Italians were really good. England weren't so good. And there were things in the game that you go, it's not going to work. This is never going to catch on. Those things have been eliminated, the athleticism, the desire, the ambition of the players, the professionalism of it. It's a really good work. My son goes to watch more. He always goes to the Women's Cup final. He's grown up with football, and he can come to Woking anytime he wants. When he was young, I used to take him to work, and he'd sit with a sub sometimes, which he I don't think he realised at the time. He realises now what a privilege was. Kanu scored a hat trick, a famous hat trick for Arsenal at Chelsea. I was commentating, and it was pouring with rain. And at the end of the game, he got soaked. I don't know how old he'd be, 12 or 14. They gave him Kanu's tracksuit top, which still exists in our house, I think, somewhere. And he was a little boy, and this massive thing around it. So I know why we've got onto this subject. All I can say is, from where I sit at Sky Sports, everybody wants to see the diversity. Everybody wants to see the inclusivity. But you've got to be good enough. And that's the ones that have broken through. And you too have applied your trade so successfully. You're good enough. And I wouldn't want, if my skills fail me, I don't want to be there just because I'm somebody who's been around for a while. I shouldn't be there. You've got to play for your place. That's what football teaches you. It is a truly wonderful game, played by very good people and by elite sports people. And honestly, you know, you've asked me a lot about myself. I still have to pinch myself to believe that I'm a part of it.
Thank you for your time.
No, thank you. I'm honoured to be part of it. And, you know, I can only wish more power to you and to Hayley and to the podcast and to all of those who are trying to follow in your footsteps.
The Offside Rule Exclusives is produced by Offside Productions and edited by Lucy Lavery.
Put your feet up with over 1,000 like Deadpool 2.
Great, sorted.
Relax with over 1,000 movies and 300 box sets streaming on Now TV. 18 plus, month passes auto renew, terms apply.